So when it comes to metrics, why do you want to talk about that? Pardon? What else? Pardon? Yeah. The thing with metrics is the problem I notice most people have with it is they look at too much shit. Like, that's definitely what people do. If you look at the goal with metrics is to make it as simple as possible. Like, really good investors, when they come to an investment decision, if it is made on any more than three critical assumptions and three figures, they will not do it. It has to be based on something simple, because it's hard to actually know anything and measure anything and get it really right and really check yourself. You know what I mean? Like, so if it's built on a labyrinth of shit, like, chances are you're going to get it wrong. No, but I'm saying about an investor that's investing in something, like, it'll be on three, like, critical assumptions. Yeah. I mean, even when we broke Amazon down to, like, some critical things, like, you can kind of see why it's successful. Fastest shipping, lowest prices, widest selection, cheapest shipping. You get those things right, like, you know what's going to happen. You know what I mean? Like, they're measurable, too. And you can, it's not like vague. You can't say we're the most customer obsessed. An investor's gonna be like, what do I do with this? Like, prove it.
But that's for the investor, but within each department, within Amazon, don't you have a ton of metrics, for example, their delivery stations and things like that?
For a fulfillment center, they have certain metrics that they follow, right? Each part of the organization.
True, there's like lots of numbers, but there's always like a few key ones. For example, I know for a fact that they have one main customer satisfaction metric, which is counterintuitive. It's number of tickets per order. What that means is number of support inquiries per order. The closer that is to zero, the more happy people are. It means more if someone doesn't email support and they order, that is actually how they're happiest, right? Because you know, if you order something, if you have to just even send an email or do a live chat, you're already pissed, right? Like, you're already done. You don't give a shit about how polite that person is. Like, if they'd really done their job, you wouldn't be there. So like, that's theirs. But a lot of other people, like fucking AT&T and a bunch of other like really terrible companies, you're calling them and you're pissed off and they're asking you what number, you're like, what's your number? I'm like, it's your network and I'm calling you. Surely you know my fucking number. And then you tell it to them and then they go through like 50 verification steps and then they tell you they can't help you. And then 10 minutes like later you get a phone call and you answer it and they want to know how satisfied you are. Jesus, like, that's really, like, Amazon knows what they're doing. Like, they would never do some shit like that. They know that they can measure it. They're trying to figure out how happy their angry customers are. Like, another thing I find interesting is all, like, the airport in Dublin, when you go out of it, there's this smiley face thing. Have you seen these?
Yeah.
Yeah, they've got three of them. And I'm like walking out and I see it and I'm like, this has been pretty good. I always hit the smiley. And then when I came back from there to New York, JFK, I was fucking looking for this thing. I was about to just smash it. And they didn't have one. No American airports give a shit about how you feel. That's why they're like that. Like, there's none of those things in sight. Yeah, but the thing is that the people that are often listening to the feedback, like, they've already made all of the fixes and it's good, like, but the people that aren't, they generally don't care. There's none of those machines at the DMV either. I figured out the way around that. Power of attorney. Yeah. That's the way around the DMV. You just make someone else you, and then you send them. Seriously, like, there's ways around these things. Like, do you really think, like, Warren Buffett goes to the DMV? Pardon? So I don't think there's any way around a driver's license, because you can't get someone to power of attorney that. But you can do it for all of the other stuff. Yep.
So you say you're customer obsessed. What metrics do you use or KPIs to measure the success of your customers?
That's a good question. And we don't really have, like, there's a few we have for that, because it's hard to measure that one, because we're in an interesting business where, like, people, ultimately the best metric is the success of, like, the people in their businesses, but that's quite, that we don't have good visibility of that, you know what I mean? We do have some feedback mechanisms where people report it and tell us, but we ask for testimonials and we do try and, like, understand it. The Facebook group, people ring the bell, and so, like, we can get a sense of how, like, happy and successful people are in that group. And then on a customer support side, we can see how happy people are there. We've got a refund rate thing, we can look at that. And then ultimately, though, I think if I had to tell you one thing that I'd look at, I would just go to the Facebook groups that our customers are in, right? And I just look for, I just search for my name.
Mm-hmm. Like the ClickFunnels group, yeah. You search for Sam Robinson.
Do that. Sort by most recent and read it. That's probably the best metric you got.
So, but you don't use any KPIs. Like, you could actually use, like, the number of tickets a customer writes in his life to you.
True, but ultimately, like, we're looking for people. It takes the hardest thing to get from a customer is for them to, like, actively promote you to other people. Like, that's the highest level, right? Even when they're not even getting compensated for that. So that's how you know when you're doing a good job. If there's none of that, which then you've got to fall back on some other things, like refund rate, like satisfaction rate of support tickets, and just the general kind of sense in the community. Yeah. So that's a hard one to, like, gauge, but what people are saying about, the best thing you can see is if in your community people are saying, what's the best course on this? And if people always say that, and it's you, then you're doing a good job. That's a good sign. But when it comes to, like, the financial stuff, it's a lot easier to measure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. That one's a hard one. Like, even, no one can really get that right in this space, because, you know, even universities talk about success rate, but it's just the amount of people that pass the exams. Like, that's not necessarily a success. You know what I mean? So, like, you've got to look at how people are measuring it.
Do you look at the engagement the customers have inside the online course, the online portal, like how many videos are being watched and for how long?
Yes. That, like, obviously engagement is, like, the first sign, like, people watching it, people, like, uploading action items, people, like, engaging in the community, like, these things are good signs, but ultimately this can still be going on and people might not be getting results. at the end of the day, the results speak the loudest about like the quality of the course, you know what I mean?
And have you ever thought about an automatic process to get to know about the results of your customers?
Yeah, I mean, try thinking about that. It's very hard. Because, I mean, if you're asking them, like, that's even open to, like, people who don't know their numbers, which is, like, everybody, and people who lie. So, like, it's still not, like, really accurate. Like, yeah. But there's some people that, like, you can tell they're definitely, like, they have like a successful business because they go on to like build a team and you hear stories of them in the market and their customers are like, yeah.
And when do you know you should ask somebody for a testimonial?
When like they've had success and you like you should ask them right then.
So like after they rang the bell or posted in the group, they made 100K or something like that?
Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. Cool.
From your clients, is it, because I know you have a couple of thousand of them from Consulting Accelerator alone. So I was wondering, what is that process for you to collect those?
Well, like I just said I built a new version of the course, and I said I'd give it to everyone for free, even ship them a box set, if they transitioned to the new one, and part of that was like uploading a testimonial.
So I know you mentioned that like briefly in Uplevel. I didn't know if there was another way to do that with, I don't know, a smaller group if you haven't given them all an upgrade or I don't know.
The easiest way is honestly just if there's people that have success, ask them. Yeah, you don't need 3,000. Mm. Like, just ask someone, like, hey, man, can you make me a testimonial? That's how I got, like, most of the main ones. Like, Andrew Argues and, like, Dave Rogemoses and, like, a bunch of people who, like, got to seven figures. Like, a lot of those original, like, ones were just because I asked them.
And you ask them just for a testimonial? Or, like, do you say, hey, can you just film a quick video on your phone and upload it here? Or give them some link or something?
I just said, hey, can you make a video just short on your phone? Doesn't need to be fancy. And just say your name, what you do, and what life was like before joining the course, what it was like during the course, and what it's like after the course. And it only needs to be like 2-3 minutes. Before, during, after, name, niche, business, end. Yeah, that's it. So with metrics, you want to be careful of like too many metrics. If you look at too many numbers, you will not know what's going on, guaranteed, right? And if you look at the wrong numbers, you will also not know what's going on. So you want to limit the amount of numbers you look at. I look at very few, and one I care about more than anything else by a mile. So like that one would just be just the net cash flow. Right, so like we'll start with defining that. So I want to look at this daily. It's from yesterday's data. So like, you know, banks will typically have like pending stuff during the day, but then overnight, like a bunch of things have fallen into like line items. I just look at basically month to date, what is the total flow of cash into bank account less the total flow of cash out of bank account, right? Now, how you can get yourself into trouble here is when you have a shitload of different bank accounts. in a PayPal account, and like maybe 7 of them. And credit cards, maybe 6 credit cards, 6 PayPals, 4 banks with 6 accounts per bank, right? That you don't do that to yourself. Because this will take you 10 hours to figure out every day. And it will still probably be wrong. So like, I only have to look at really 2 bank accounts. Mm-hmm.
Do you accept PayPal for your courses?
No, but if like it's a sales, if someone emails in and they ask, then we'll like support rep will tell them, yes, send it to this account. Or if it's a strategy session, they might say, send it to this account. So it's there for like a last catch, but it's not a main method. Like you don't know you can pay with it.
When it goes into the balance, because I accept PayPal, so the balance gets pretty high. I'm sure a lot of people here accept PayPal. So the balance gets pretty high.
Well, it's pretty high.
Like 200K.
Yeah, don't do that.
That's what I'm saying. So like, if you want to, my question was like how, if you did accept PayPal, how do you like, as soon as the money goes into PayPal, you
move it into your account? But since
I would always move it out.
Okay.
Because they locked $500,000 of mine for like 6 months once, yeah. And I'm pretty sure I still have 50 grand that I can't get out from like 2 years ago or some shit, because I don't have enough time. So like, I really despise that company. They're terrible, like honestly. Do you not use Stripe? Do you use PayPal instead?
No, I use Stripe, and it's 60-40, Stripe, PayPal.
Got it. Yeah. I would never feel too comfortable, like, relying too much on PayPal. Like, I know so many stories of people, like, getting screwed. Stripe, on the other hand, like, I've never had a problem with them. Yes.
I don't know what that term is.
Chargeback.
Chargeback. Does a refund count as a chargeback?
No. Doesn't. So what? But if they've already like done a chargeback and then you refund it, that's still a chargeback.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's still a chargeback, yes. Because they did a chargeback.
Right. So
but if they ask for a refund and then you give them a refund, that's not a chargeback.
So from time to time I'll make a sale, I'll know it's a fraudulent transaction from a couple of attributes, right? And so, and they always buy on a pay plan, so someone wants to copy or something like that. So I instantly refund if I think that. But is that fraudulent transaction, if I don't pick it up, a chargeback?
If they do a chargeback?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't actually have full control of that metric?
No. But they've designed that metric so that generally the only reason you'd be over that is if you're doing something sketchy.
Okay, and also is it based on transactions or dollar volume?
They calculate it on both. So if you're over on both, then they'll probably close you. But if you're only over on one, they might give you a bit of wiggle room. Yeah. Low, maybe like 30-40% or something.
How do you win?
Well, we have a contract that people sign, so like even with that it's only like 30% or something.
Yeah,
like,
I haven't won. We have like contracts, like they're signed, still haven't won.
Yeah, I mean it's just the cost of doing business on the internet. But if your chargeback rate's over like 1.5%, like you're doing something wrong. Yeah, and you will have big problems. Well, there's a refund policy. Like, so if they asked within like 2 weeks, then like we'll ask them to provide like some evidence of them taking action, because it's like action based.
Yeah.
But ultimately, if they haven't and they still insist and they're within 2 weeks, we'll refund them.
But after 2 weeks, if they say, yeah, it doesn't fit into the refund policy, but I'm going to propose some negative reviews or things like that, do you fight that?
We'd probably, like, if someone was like that, we'd probably just refund them.
Yeah.
It's not worth it. Like, people can do more harm than a refund, yeah.
We've seen, like, if we give any friction with the refund or something like that, like, someone will pop up on a blog, like, the next day, and then that just hurts us so much.
Right.
Because, like, buyers, they do their research before. If they find any sort of shady shit, they're going to be repelled, right? Yeah, we do. And sometimes I, like, respond to them, and, like one guy's not even a customer. He's leaving us bad reviews, and, like, called him out. It's like, you're, yeah.
Was your company trademarked? Pardon me? Is your program trademarked?
Not in the U.S., but in Canada.
Okay. Yeah. I removed all my negatives by just doing trademark, because I trademarked my name.
Yeah, well, technically, that... It's like they don't have to remove it.
Yeah, but
some you'll find someone that will be a bit smarter, and they'll be like, "Fuck you! You can't do anything, and you can't." So like, I wouldn't worry about trying to get rid of things. Like, there's just a bunch of people out there that try to like get their start from like trying to like prey on other people. Yeah, but they're never going to win. So, like, who cares? Someone who's doing that as a strategy, I'd almost laugh. Like, that's not even a strategy.
Yeah, I just called him out in the blog thread. I was like, this guy is a competitor, clearly not as good, zero case studies, and I just, like, tore apart his funnel. And then the guy emailed me back, apologized, emailed the blog person, and they took the whole thread down.
I wouldn't even look. Because if they make me spend 1 minute of time, then, like, they've harmed me in some way. But if I don't even give, if I don't even know, they haven't touched me. Yeah. Or they haven't wasted any of my time. And I know in the long term I will still win. So, like, against them for sure. So, like, that's satisfying enough for me. Yeah. So I just ignore it. Like, I don't even look. Because if I did look, then I would worry. And you can't, no one has enough discipline to look and not worry. So the only solution is not to look. And the only exception to that is if it's customers, actual ones, you have to look at that. That's a legitimate concern. So if in my customer group people were saying shit, I read all of that. Mm. But if it's like just bunch of idiots just talking like all sorts of nonsense, like I don't even look. Because people say negative stuff about everyone. Like, just Google like anyone that's ever done anything and you'll find thousands of things.
Up as an objection, would that be a concern?
I don't know. That never really popped up as an objection for me. What do you guys do?
It's just from people that are pissed off online, and then I'll just express that point and then let it sit with them. If they want to come and buy, they buy, but if not, no big deal.
If you look hard enough, you'll see my customers at war with the people. I don't even have to get involved. That's how. That's what happens if you don't get involved. So I never engage in any of those. But now when I look at some of those things, my customers are in there being like, this is bullshit. Like, that's a good sign. And you just let that happen. But I'm never going to get involved. Because you almost look guilty when you get involved. You know what I mean? Yeah.
So if you don't... You wouldn't be bothered deleting. You just don't look guilty.
Yeah, and I would never delete. Ever. Because that's the ultimate sign of guilt. Like, oh shit, this can't be here. Yeah. Like, I just leave it all there. Because if you really didn't care and it really wasn't true, then why do you even delete it?
I took your advice on that, yeah, 18 months ago. I did the same, where I just don't care. But the people I work with really care about their negative comments. And I
Yeah, everyone will go through that when they're like a beginner, you know, like... Because when you're a normal civilian, generally no one says anything about you on the internet.
That's right.
But when you're no longer a civilian, like, and you've got, you're like reaching hundreds of thousands, or in my case, like we've served hundreds of millions of impressions.
Yeah.
There's bound to be a whole bunch of stuff. And so that's normal. And if you can't handle that, then you're not cut out for it, yeah. Yeah, but like that doesn't really do anything. You like there's freedom of speech, right? Like Donald Trump couldn't trademark his name, which is already trademarked, and then say no one could talk about me. Like,
yeah, I would just
that
say,
doesn't
like,
work
for people that would potentially like rip off your stuff.
Pardon?
If someone's trying to rip off your stuff or clone it or whatever.
I mean, that's not even really a trademark thing. That's more like in, like, copyright, IP kind of thing. And that's a problem with, like, online courses. I mean, you should have some... You should fight it. Like, we have a contractor that works with us that actively takes things down. Like, these are the pirated things, right? We actively go after all of those and take them down and... close their PayPal accounts and freeze things, and we actively fight that.
Oh, really?
But we don't do anything about people that just say, oh, I don't like that guy.
Yeah,
they're allowed to say whatever they want. But when someone's like stealing our shit and trying to sell it, that's different. Yeah. No. You don't need to be trademarked. Like if someone's legitimately like selling your things illegally, like PayPal will rip them apart.
Sam, tell me more about that. I've had my stuff copied and you can buy it for $90. What are you saying? How do you go after these people?
You can't really. You can only just get it taken down.
But how do you do that?
Well, like, there's the DMCA, Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Like, you've probably seen some things at the bottom of Google that says stuff's removed.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, like, you need a, like, DMCA takedown... contractor basically, and what they basically do is they set up like keywords, like what's the one we use that's in, pardon, it's called Czar or something Czar, take down Czar or something. Have you heard of this? Does anyone know what I'm talking about? I think between we pay that company like $500 a month, and then I'm pretty sure we pay it, like we've got another guy we pay, like an individual guy, probably like $2,000 a month. So we only spend about $2,500 a month on that, and we don't fix that problem, like there's still, but we make it hard. Yeah. And then that's all you can really do.
And how do you go about taking out their PayPal account? Because that's what this guy does. So what is someone physically on your behalf writing to PayPal saying, telling the story?
Well, he just figures out what, like, wants to be a customer, knows what the PayPal account is, and then goes around to PayPal and reports it, and they freeze the account. And then they create a new one, and we freeze the new one, and we just keep relentlessly just fucking with them until they stop selling our course.
Right.
Mm.
Do you sue them as well?
Pardon?
If you know who it is, do you sue them? Or?
Do you know how hard it is to sue somebody? It's like a big job, right? Like, it's going to take like some years and like a shitload of money and like a lot of time. So like, you don't do that for that. Yeah.
Yeah, we talked about like, we knew one guy. We thought about, okay, if we show that we have no mercy, then people won't do it quicker.
It's honestly, you should just have like a contractor that takes stuff down. But that's like all you should do.
Yeah.
Like if you're thinking about it, I honestly don't think about it at all. Like every, like in the last month, it hasn't even been a thought. Yeah. Because you're mostly going to get results by just focusing on your customer, making your product better, hiring good people, watching your cash flow, not dealing with that. Yeah. That's like a, that's a loser activity. Same with like reading people's negative comments and engaging. Loser job. Yeah.
Where did you hire that contractor from?
He was one of our customers. Yeah. But I think it's called Takedown SAR. T-Z-A-R, or however you spell that ZAR word, yeah.
T-S-A-R.
Yeah. But there's people that do it, and then there's like, or you could Google DMCA takedown contractor or something. Like, it's a big thing. Like, you know, movies have to do it, right? Record labels have to do it. There's a lot of people that have to deal with this thing. Like, But you, this is not... If you spend more than 1 hour, like you shouldn't even spend 1 hour a month. This is a petty thing. Yeah. Yep.
What are the other metrics you look at?
Well, first of all, does everyone know how to calculate this one? Because this is really the only one I look at. You need to be able to calculate this daily. Like, that it gets difficult when you have multiple bank accounts, and if you have credit cards and PayPals and things, or a Venmo, or God knows what other things there are. Like, you need to really simplify it. Like, you should only really have one checking account, one bank account, and one credit card linked to that one checking account with one company. If you have any more than that, that's too complicated, and you won't be able to do the books. So I have like more accounts than that, but I also have a full-time accountant, right? I'm talking about if you're gonna do this shit yourself, like you might have your personal bank account with one account and then your company account, like, but it doesn't really need, you don't need a savings account separate from that. Like, what's the point?
That I think of as money for to pay taxes with, so that the number I'm seeing in my checking account is always sort of assumed that taxes has been taken out of that.
So and I would just three of calculate them. That in my head. Like, I wouldn't create new accounts, because the problem I have with multiple accounts is like, you're trying to figure out, hey, what was that one going out of that and into that? And then what was that one going out of that and into that? And then when you go to like try and reconstruct this thing, it's like a real complexity. Because they're not income, they're not flows of income. They're also not outflows of expense. Like, these are like just movements of money around. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it gets confusing. Also, we don't even use a credit card. Well, I just have a debit card. So like that way, if I have an expense, it's gone out of the account. So I, what I see is always what I get. Yeah.
Do you use a finance company to finance your students if they need to?
No. Yeah. Well, I don't know anyone that's actually done that, like, and actually been able to show me something. Like,
PayPal credit, for example,
so PayPal credit we accepted when we accepted PayPal, but then that ended up in like our PayPal account getting frozen. So then I realized that it was best just not to accept PayPal, right? So like, yeah, because I don't like complexity. That thing took like weeks of my time. Like, I'm not going to go down that avenue again just for a little increase in conversion rate. Plus, if people like do refunds or disputes, now you've got to manage disputes in like multiple locations. Because if it's in Stripe, it's all in Stripe and it's simple. But if it's in bloody PayPal, they've got two ways to do it. Once through the PayPal system and then once with their credit card company, like it's a shitstorm. And then if you have a lot of scale and your support people now need access to PayPal and then they're moving things, are like, there goes your time. Now you're done. Honestly, that's how it happens. It just gets you like that. You have to just simplify and fight back the complexity. It's like, could we get a finance company? Yeah, we probably could, but no. Do we use the PayPal thing? No. No, no, no. Fighting it back. Yeah.
Is working for him or not, like a financing company? Yeah, one of the calls he mentioned it.
Yeah, I mean, people have told me it, but no one showed me it. Yeah.
Don't do monthly payment plans or anything?
No, they're all right. Like, you should try to do as little of them as possible. It's better to get money up front, but they're not that bad. Yeah. But you want to know, like, the problem I have with credit cards is, let's say you've got your checking account, and let's say it's got 100 grand in it, right? Then let's say you get a Stripe thing come in every day, and it's like the next day, 20 grand extra comes in. You've got 120 grand. You're like, oh, I've got 120 grand. Things are going good. But you might have accumulated 50 grand on your card, and it's not showing in there. Do you know what I mean? So it gives you this false sense of like what's going on. Yeah. And sure, you could go and read the credit card thing and then you could go and read that one and then like do a bit of math, but I'm already like, fuck the points. I'd rather have simplicity. Yeah. I'll take simplicity over points any day. And that's why we hook up Facebook and AdWords directly to our bank account. We don't do that one through a card. Because that card, if it declines, which it always does because of the fraud protection thing, right? Not because it doesn't have money. Like, in America, they lock cards all the time. And I've had to, like, the biggest concern was that my media buyers would be like, holy shit, ads had stopped. Like, got to call up, like, the bank and got to deal with them and unlock it. And it causes mayhem. So we just removed that and just linked it straight up to the account. It never, ever, ever declines. It's impossible. Unless you don't have any money. Yeah.
You don't have a billing threshold where you have it set up that way, right? Like, it just bills you every single day.
It does bill you cleaner because, like, you don't get, like, them every, like, $500 or every, like, 1,000 or 5 grand or something. It just does one, which makes your life easier when you're doing your books, right? Because you just have, each day has a transaction. Like, you don't get 50 pages of Facebook transactions, right? You want to try to remove, like, reduce the complexity as much as you possibly can. Our bank statements now are 4 pages a month. Yeah. They used to be about 200. Yeah. But I've really worked to make it simple. Because Stripe only sends one a day, just the ads only come out one a day. We're only using like 2 channels. And then payroll happens like once every 2 weeks, right? Like what other stuff is there? Like then you've just got some Amazon things and then you've got some rent and then you've got like a couple of just purchase things you did. Like it's not really that complicated, but people make it complicated. So you want to simplify this so you can figure this out, most people couldn't figure out what their net cash flow is with 2 days. If I gave them 2 days, they still wouldn't be able to figure out that number. Because they've even got some credit cards they forgot they had. It's wild. You should not use the credit, like, the debt. Yeah, I don't have any of it. Zero. So you work out the cash in, the cash out, and you get a number that's either going to be like minus or positive. Good? Not so good. Day to day, right? But if you're looking at it from like a week to week, or a month to month. At the month to month level, it's like good, bad, like, but on a day basis, it's all right. But when it's like over a week, like, you got to watch that. If it goes a month like that, you got to really watch that. Day to day though, it's not like, you don't need to worry if one day you make less than another. Cause if you have like if rent and payroll and all of these things run on one day, like, or you have a one-off purchase thing that's quite expensive, like, you'll have some days that are in the red.
Then why do you check it?
Pardon?
If it doesn't really matter for that specific day, what's the purpose of checking it daily versus weekly? Like, what are you trying to see?
Well, for one, you're trying to like understand what goes out and what goes in, right? Like, just so you know, because you might be like, wait, what's that? And you want to spot it when it happens so you can cut it. Like, yeah, but he isn't in the position that I'm in. So like, he might think some software, for example, is necessary. Like, I might see it and I might be like, we don't need that. Yeah. Or something might not make sense, or like it's, if you keep your eye on the flows, like, you'll get a good reading. Like, when they're doing business turnarounds, like people that do like buy distressed assets, right? And then they come in and they turn them around. Like, there's this guy in New Zealand called Graham Hart, who's like worth like $15 billion or something. Started from zero. And he buys distressed assets using leverage buyouts and then like turns them around. And he's never done an interview ever, except he recently did one like last year. 2 years ago that I watched, and he talks about what he does. One of the first things he does is he like takes over all of the, he controls the money in and out. So like, no one has a card, no one has a checkbook. If anyone wants to buy anything, they've got to come to him, right? And then he signs all the checks and look like he controls the flow. And he has this funny story. He said that like, one company he bought, someone came to him, like an invoice came in and like person bought it to him, and it was for like $250,000. And it was for the sponsorship of a giraffe at like a zoo that the company had been paying for ages, right? And he has the saying that there's always a giraffe somewhere. So he said, you have to look, because there's always a giraffe, always. Right? There's multiple of them. Like, there's all sorts of shit going on, and like, it gets hard. There's more of it when you get bigger, and like, you need to maintain that visibility. This is a really simple way to keep that visibility. Make sense? Because you want to catch things. It's easy to fix things when you catch them on the day, right? But when it's like a week, So that I look at that number, and if it's going good, that's good. If it's not going so good day to day, I don't mind. But if it's a month that isn't so good, then I'm like, why? So generally, if this number's good, like, we just keep going, right? But if over like a week or a month it's not good, then I ask the question, why? actually, I look at both extremes. If you look at your best month, and you also look at your worst, and you ask why, you'll learn a lot. I know all of ours. Like, they've taught me some of the biggest lessons. And I know, like, what they look like. So I can spot the trends earlier when, like, one of those things is going on. You know what I mean? For example, I learned in January last year, we lost in one single month $500,000. I think that's the most we've ever lost in a single month. That was the worst. And why? We changed the webinar. Like, we swapped it out. Like, we changed, like, we were running like the new version, and then we changed it back to the old one, and then we were indecisive, and we like changed it again, and like it caused mayhem. And so we learned, basically, I had this like visualization of like, we are on this little island here with like a tree surrounded by some ocean, right? And there's a pipe that has like food in it. And when you have a pipe, one, that passes you food on an island, never, ever, ever fuck with the pipe. Ever. Ever. Because that was like our main, like we weren't selling another product. Like we were just selling Accelerator. And we were spending a lot of money on ads. And there was no other way we could receive money because we had nothing else to sell. And there was no way anyone could even buy Accelerator without going through the webinar. So like, we had one pipe and we screwed with it and it caused mayhem. So I learned like never, ever, ever fuck with the pipe. That's why like you'll never see me change like landing pages and stuff unless it's no longer the main pipe. You never screw with the main pipe. When like you've got another main pipe and then another like main pipe, you can start to screw with one of the pipes. But don't do it when you've only got one. Like, be, you really shouldn't screw with this at all. Like, if it's working, leave. If it's not working, you don't have much to lose, right? Because it's not working. There's no food coming in. So you've got no risk to fuck with it. But if it's working, I've learned like you got more chance of doing harm than good. So just keep your hands away from it. Yeah.
We're making the jump from the, we have a converting VSL that's, it's getting a lot of applications, but our schedules are maxed with 3 reps. And the solution was either hire a bigger team or
basically switch to the JIT. So we just completed the JIT, got the funnel, everything's running, we just haven't turned on traffic. So would you just keep running traffic to the VSL and then another channel would be that JIT? I guess that's the obvious answer, right? Is to
this I didn't give you this example to say like build multiple pipes. I said if you only have one, there's nothing wrong with only having one. Just don't fuck with it. Yeah.
So but in this case the VSL is, it's capped and we have to make the decision to either fully jump to the JIT, which runs the risk of it not converting as well.
So is your VSL working?
Yes, but we can't scale past.
But also we tested a raise in price and it was massive decline in conversions.
All right, well, we can troubleshoot this thing. And this will bring us into some other metrics, but it really, I'll get to your story in a sec, but why I'm showing you this simple thing is that this is really as simple as it needs to be. Like, you look at this, and then if it's positive, if it's negative, you ask why, and then you learn not to do that again, and you should catch it early, right? But you also need to look at these, like your best months, and you ask why, and you like look back at it, and you need a contrast of both, like some down ones and some positive ones. And then you ask the question, why? And then the best thing to do is look at what you did. And the best thing I've got that tells me that is my warm app. You know that thing I use? Do people use it? Yeah. That thing is like responsible for a lot of my success. It's just a Google sheet that I turned into a calendar. But I look back at that month in there and it says all of the things I did. If I didn't do something, I wouldn't have like left it on that sheet. I would have moved it forward. So only things that are done are like on those cells in there. So I look back and I'm like, what did we do in this month? And it tells me everything. So like I looked at our best month ever, which was like January this year, which was pretty much the inverse of like, it was like precisely the inverse of this. It was like 3 million revenue and 500,000 net cash profit. Yeah. So it was the precise opposite. And then I looked at what we did and I sent the most emails I've ever sent. I know because I also had to upgrade my sending limit on ActiveCampaign past 10 million a month. I got the email history of it. Like, that was the first time I ever went near the limit of my account, and I had to get it unlocked. And I segmented my list and started mailing accelerator people towards up-level, and then leads I started emailing to both up-level and accelerator in like a one-on, one-off, one-on, one-off. And so I segmented it, and I started sending like 2 emails a day, 1 to each segment. And I did that for a whole month, and I sent the most emails I'd ever sent. And I also did 1 blog video a week, each week, that was quite high quality. And we also had some ads running, but like, that happened on that month. And then I didn't really know that that was responsible for that month until like some month later, where it must have been like May or something. And I was really busy, so I didn't do like any blog posts, zero. And I didn't send any emails, zero. And it was like, I think we just didn't make any money. It was just like break even, zero. And then I asked the question like, why? And I looked at my warm app, no blog videos, no emails, and the ads were running well, and everything was going good there, but the profit had just gone. And the only thing that had changed was the emails and the blog videos. So then it took me all of this to learn just that that was really important. So you see what I mean, how I didn't learn it from actually the good month, but I knew what I did in that good month. And then when I didn't do it 1 month, then I knew what it was. And I was like, got it. Yeah, when you need to find out what those little things are. The things that actually like move the needle, because there's all sorts of shit in there. Like there's Instagram stories. Stopped doing those, didn't even see a little ripple. Stopped doing all sorts of stuff and never seen a blip. And then I'm like, whoa, I was putting all of that energy into that and nothing happened. Nothing. Just crickets. Social media shit, like just like posting and being one of those people on social media. Even like, you know, the negative stuff that like, or pirate sites, I've never even seen that do shit to like the numbers, you know what I mean? But there's some things that really move the numbers, like the number of strategy sessions, full calendars or not. If the calendars aren't full, like, and people aren't on the phones, yeah, that'll move the numbers. And then emails is a great way to fill up calendars. You can fill up the calendars so much, so it's so much more easy for me to fill the calendars with an email than it is with Facebook ads. I could fill 3 reps' calendars for like 9 days with one email. Done. I would get 250 strategy sessions from an email. Pardon? Yes. But mostly it's just sending straight to the survey. That was the little trick. Like, instead of sending to the video and then the video has the survey, I just cut out that middle link and went straight to the survey. That's how you get like 20 times the output. So if you need to fill the, that's another thing I check daily. So like James, who's my accountant, will give me this number, right? Then I'll go to Jesse and I'll message Jesse and I'll be like, Jesse, are the calendars full? Question mark. And he'll say, yep, or no. And if they're full, I'll be like, cool. And I know I don't really need to send an email. And if he's like, no, but they're almost full, so I don't know if you should send an email to everyone, so I might cut off a segment of 20,000 and email it to them, right? And then just with that, I know I can fill up the balance. So like, I need to get 2 numbers, like this one to know if this is like a vital sign. And then I need to go to Jesse and be like, are the calendars full? He'll tell me. And then I know that my main instrument to fill them is an email.
Why are you hiring more reps?
Because we don't really need to.
But if you could send an email, calendars.
Yeah, but we've had, like, we only learned this trick recently, right? So, like, we haven't been able to fill calendars consistently for a long period of time. Once I know that we can do it like for months, then I'll like have the confidence to add more reps.
When you're asking Jesse if the calendar's full, how far out are you specifically referring to?
Jesse, when I ask you if the reps calendars are full, how far out are you looking?
Your ad budget and stop or reduce the number of people coming in, aren't you going to run out of people like in a short amount?
That's why we haven't fully stopped running ads.
But you like drastically minimize it, like going from 40,000 a spend to 1,000.
Yeah, but most of that was going to Accelerator. So like, it's got nothing to do with really calls.
What does that mean? I don't understand. So
of that money was being like, we were always only spending about $1,500 a day on up-level ads. But most of that 40 was Accelerator.
Isn't the biggest source of your clients for the up-level Accelerator?
No.
I see. Okay. That makes sense then. Yeah.
What percentage do you think Accelerator upsells make up of up-level sales? Yeah. See how the numbers start to like make sense, but it's complicated, right? Like,
someone asked it earlier, but would you mind sharing your free trial numbers? Maybe the versions of that?
Sure, I can do that. I'll make a note to do that. Did I solve your one? No, I didn't do your one either.
the question on sending people directly to the schedule. Do you find that there are any unqualified people?
Hold on. What was your question was to do with what? Yeah. But we're starting to get pulled into the weeds. I'll get to the weeds, but you're never really going to create much. You're never really going to get a big win, and you're not going to avoid a big loss if you look in the weeds. You know what I mean? So, like, the main things you want to look at are out here, like at these big things. All I honestly need to do each day to make sure that the company's going to work is look at the cash flow, and then look at the calendars, are they full? If they're not, I send an email, and then they are. And then I'm basically done. And if that happens, then also the reps need to do those calls and stuff, and like, we need to make sure the operations work and the support tickets get done and like, things are happening and new projects are being built out and all of that. But in terms of the day-to-day operations, that's about as simple as it is. Yeah.
So what's your strategy when the interviews ask the question?
I don't really know if we will. Like, what we notice is that people aren't really, like, unsubscribing. Like, people are trying to get on. And people are like, people like it. It's not like we're selling people like relentlessly on the list, you know? We're really just keeping on making. That's why the blog videos are crucial. Yeah, I make sure the large majority of this stuff is helpful and valuable. So like, you only burn something out if you're like taking more than giving. And also, we're still getting people join our list, like lots. Even organically, it's hundreds a day. Yeah, so like, and then we've got refer a friend entering people in and accelerator buyers and all sorts of stuff going on. So like, the list is getting replenished and we don't email people that aren't engaged. So we're not harming our reputation with like the ISPs. And we provide value in the emails, so like, there's a real reason for people to stay on. And then we get a lot from YouTube too, flowing in like that. YouTube surprised me. I don't have many subscribers at all. I think, 68,000. Yeah, which according to like most YouTubers, I'm like, I suck. Yeah.
Is there a call to action in every one of your YouTube videos?
No. I would make more money from my YouTube subscribers at 68,000 than many would at like multiple millions. Yeah.
So.
Because the only reason why someone follows my stuff, it's not very entertaining. Like some dude in a whiteboard, there's no music, there's no woman, there's no cars, there's no fucking anything. It's a dude in a whiteboard talking about some business. So like that's the reason why I don't have many subscribers, but it's also the reason why I have the right ones. Like if you look at the numbers, our view count, like when we do a new video, will pretty much match the subscriber count. No one else's thing does that. They might have like 4 million subscribers, they do a YouTube video, it gets the same number of views that my one does. I'm like, something's not right here. Like.
So there must be some call to it.
Here's the thing I learned is that it's more powerful not to like put a call to action in the videos than it is to put one in those videos, right? Because it's not a funnel video. You need a call to action in one of those. But if you just help someone, you just read the comments on there, man. People are like, if you read the comments on my YouTube channel versus like Facebook ads or some crap, like there's a different type of human on YouTube.
Yeah, it's much more positive, but no.
It's like rare to ever see like a negative comment. Ever. And people like they say that they love me. Honestly, it's kind of strange. I like totally underestimated that channel. Like it's.
And you're saying they will find you.
I know they do because they tell me in the comments, they're like, I'm saving for this right now, I'm gonna buy this thing, and then people say, your videos are the reason why I purchased this thing, and then everyone's like, me too, me too, me too, me too, me too. It's kind of interesting. So the combination of some ads, because people have to find out about you somehow, right? Some ads, some YouTube videos to stir the pot, and some emails to keep reminding people and even distributing these things. It also brings people back to be on your retargeting lists, because when I send an email, I link to the blog, which has the YouTube video embedded. Yeah. So they land on the website, retargeting pixel. So then they fall back into the retargeting bucket. So now they're getting those impressions again. So it's all made like this.
You just try and identify how many contacts per calendar. If you're sending two emails a week, what would you get? What number would you?
I don't know. It's email list is a funny thing. I remember when I had 3,000 people on my list back in New Zealand, and I could do a six-figure product launch like that. Now that I have 1.3 million people on my list, it certainly hasn't held those proportions. You know what I mean? And so it's very hard to do email broadcast math.
Just for you, you're sending, it's three calendars, and then there's 400,000 active contacts.
Yeah. Well, if I send an email out to that, I could generate 250 bookings, an email.
Per week, right? Or per day?
Well, with an email, I don't know if I could do that every day because I've never tried, because there's no need for that. But I know that I can pretty much send one email a week, and in combination with Jesse's ads, and fill them. They're a bit smarter than that. You know what I mean? Wonder what this guy does. Let's Google him. You know, people find shit out, and they're almost more interested when you don't try sell them. You know what I mean? Because it's kind of rare for someone just to actually add some value and not ask for anything back. People learn that really quick. They're like, all right, I trust this guy. He's helped me so much for free. I'm just gonna buy this thing just to give back. Do you know what I mean?
So on your site, which I haven't explored, there's an opportunity to, there's a sales page. And is there another sales page that'll take someone to your calendar? Is that how they're finding it?
So they're finding me through all sorts of different ways, because we don't give them a direct path, right? But they might go to my website, and then they might see my courses. If they think Accelerate is a fit, they might do a trial. If they think Uplevel's a fit, they'll book a strategy session. If they think Quantum's a fit, they'll book a strategy session. And then they'll either end up on a trial or on the phone with one of the reps. And also, if they visit my site, they get retargeted. So then that follows them around, and then they find their way into the mainline funnel, even though I never directly linked them to it. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. To whatever funnel, therefore. If it's Accelerate, it'll lead to, at the moment, the trial. It would have used to have led to the webinar. And Uplevel will lead to a video. I think it's that More with Less video, which then goes to a calendar. Yeah.
This is a little bit off topic maybe, but something that I've been thinking about a lot. What is the best way to
destroy your competition other than having the best product? And because I know that's what you'll probably say, right? Having the best product. And maybe the question is, should I even focus? Should I even look at competition or no?
Yeah, you should, but you shouldn't like fixate. Because the only way you know how you measure up is by like looking at the competition, right? And then if you're not the best, then you get to work.
Maybe there's like some good books to read.
No, you just get to work. Like, by getting better, you know what I mean? But if you are the best, it's actually harder. I kind of like find it very, I love it when I know exactly who I need to get. Because fuck, it's so clear. So I just go. And that's kind of like easy, but when it's like very unclear, it gets hard, you know what I mean? Hmm. And I get quite motivated by competition, so that's how I can get myself going. I just pick a target. Mm.
Yeah, but how do you know what to do with that target?
Figure out what they're doing, do it better. Or think of something they didn't think of. Achilles heel, yeah. Or just makes, like, if they're missing, like, which most of the time, by the way, is the product, like, you look at it and you're like, really? Wow, that's not even hard. I thought I'd have to try. Yeah.
Do you buy competitors' products to study them?
No, but I used to, like, when I was learning, because, like, I would buy them for myself. Yeah. But if something was really, like, supposedly really good, I'd buy it. But I never see something that great. Like when it comes to software and things, like I'll definitely look at what they're doing. But the course space is not very hard. Like honestly, the average standard of like the online course is fucking terrible. Like so if you actually just gave like 2% of a shit, you would win. I'm not joking, it's really that easy. Imagine trying to beat someone's course versus like trying to beat Google at search. Honestly, or trying to beat like SpaceX at getting to Mars or some shit. Or Tesla at like the electric car, or Apple with the iPhone. Honestly, imagine that. You just have to care a tiny bit. And then you're there, like. It's quite easy to do that. What's hard though is to be, well, I find hard is to be famous. So, and I also don't want to be. So I would prefer to play on different terms. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Not like Kai Lopez, Grant Cardone.
Yeah, my strategy is often like asymmetric warfare. Like I'll attack what's weak and avoid what's strong. So just go straight for the Achilles, yeah. And if there isn't one, I won't touch. Yeah, well, like, I mean, for an example, like, I think you always have to believe that you really do have a chance of being the best. And so you have to know that you're like cut out for this challenge, you know what I mean? For example, if it was like being the president, and that was my, I don't think I could do that. I just don't like political crap and being on the TV and talking to people, and I'm not gonna play that. So I would never wind up in that competition. I also don't like ones that are like fame-based. So that's why I like winning on value. So I like value games. Yeah. Or numbers. And technology. Numbers, technology, and value, I like to play with those things. Yeah. So like you gotta know your strengths and like make sure that those things will help you be the best at this game.
It's a personality trait. Like Steve Jobs, he, not that he wanted to be famous, but he was leading the company with his face, whereas Google, some people don't even know who owns Google. I mean, I do, but most people, it's just Google the brand name. Because those guys, they don't want to be in front of the camera, I guess, a lot of times.
Yeah, I mean, Steve Jobs was a product guy. Like, he knew how to make great products. That's how he won. Google were like engineers, and they knew distributed systems and search. Like, that's how they won. Yeah. But we kind of drifted a bit. So you want to, this simple exercise can, you need to have like some positives and some negatives to spot the pattern. Like, the example I gave you about the emails and the blog videos. I thought it was all on the ads for a long time. So I never turned them off because like, or turned them down because I thought they were linked perfectly to the profit. But when the ads run beautifully for a whole month and I didn't do a blog video or an email and the profit went to zero, I was like, "What? Wait, what's going on in here?" And then when I put the emails back on in that and I saw it go up again, I was like, this is the thing that's doing it, right? You kind of got to play with like, do this thing, watch what happens. Don't do that thing, watch what happens. Do this thing, watch what happens. And you got to keep switching between these different things to know like, what is the causal agent of like, the output. Do you know what I mean? Because I guarantee you the things you think are the causes are not, unless you think it's like strategy sessions, because those are.
Let's say those are two variables, right? Like you're sending out blogs and emails at the same time. So how do you know which one is which?
The thing is they're like linked, because like in order to send out the emails, I need the blogs.
Right, but then YouTube has a lot of organic traffic as well.
True.
Could it be just that? Or is it mainly like
people from your email list?
Honestly, the two things are kind of the same, like the way I use them, like, yeah, they're different, but I like both together. They're very much like interlinked. Mm. And so really, if we want to do good, we just need to make sure we send out good emails consistently and make good content consistently. We also have Refer a Friend, which definitely helps. We've also got a lot of good SEO and organic reach. Like more than I thought. And then we've got YouTube, which helps a lot. And then a little bit of ads sprinkled in. And that does what, that does enough.
I can see the dip, right? When I don't send emails and when I send emails, there's a big spike. I noticed that, Andrew Argue is now doing like a lead magnet ad as one of his primary ads. What's your opinion on, you know,
I know that
list
from,
building?
Yeah, I've talked to him recently, and only 10% of his like his sales like derive from ads directly. Like,
well, I guess that's what I'm saying. What's your opinion on list building? Right. So, what's your opinion on list building? Right. To get a big email list. So, for instance, doing a very attractive lead magnet to your avatar to build a list, and then knowing that over time you have this asset that you can mail to.
It's dangerous. The key is to, you build an email list as a byproduct of like generating appointments and making sales through a normal funnel. You know what I mean? So like if you spend money driving traffic to like a VSL or a JIT or whatever, you're building an email list and you're paying for the ads each day. You don't want to ever be in a situation where you're spending money to generate leads and hoping that they're going to pay in the future and accumulating up a deficit. Do you know what I mean? That's dangerous because you don't know. They might buy, they might not. And if they don't, you're screwed. So like at least with this one, you're liquidating your cost. So you're not going down, but as a byproduct, you're building a list. Yeah. But then the key is with the list, it's the list is basically useless unless you mail it consistently and add value and produce some content. Because if you just mail like sell to your list, it'll perish fast. Yeah. A group coaching model versus?
Like during a recession, if you haven't had one.
I don't know, like, because it'd be wrong of me to say, because I think I started my, like I became an entrepreneur in like 2009, I think. So I don't know anything about those. Like, I know about recessions, but I've never been through one. So I can't speak from experience. But I can imagine what would happen.
Just revenue
like
going down.
Spending dries up. That's what happens. Like it's harder to get customers. But also at the same time, prices go down for things, which is kind of good. But only if you've got enough money, right? So like the game is like, it's kind of like musical chairs. Just make sure you get a damn chair. Honestly, when the music stops, have a chair, then you can have some fun.
And by a chair, you're just saying...
If you land on your ass on the ground.
You're saying cash in the bank?
Yeah. That's the key. You just... It's actually a great time for you if you have money. Because everything's cheap. Like, you can buy, like I'm sure the ads will get cheaper. I'm sure, like wages and, like... compensation will go down, hunger for working harder will go up, like the prices of assets will go down a lot, like you can buy things for cheap. And yeah, if you're like in a good position, I think the worst thing that gets people is always the lifestyle. That's what gets everybody. So if you just work to keep your lifestyle simple and you also have lean cost structure in your business, like the thing about ads is you don't need to spend the same amount of money on ads every day, right? You can reduce that, but you want to be able to like keep payroll, rent, and like operational expenses, and then your personal life, you need to pay for all of that. And you need to know what that number is per month, and you need to be able to easily do that.
What margin do you think we should be running at in the group coaching model? Like what percentage do you think?
Depends what you're trying to achieve, like rapid growth at all costs or accumulating cash. There's two modes. Like if I had less than $1 million, I would be in like storing cash mode. I wouldn't sleep if I had like, even if I had like 5 million cash, I'd still be terrified. So like, I wouldn't even be able to sleep or function. So like, there's a number you have to be like calm. And that always goes up the more you expand what you're doing, you know what I mean? Yeah. Plus, I also want to work on projects that have like 3-year runways. Like, I need to spend millions on it for a while before it's even going to have a chance to make any money. Like, I'm never going to touch those projects if I don't have good reserves. Those are the projects, like, when you're getting started, I think you need to work really hard to get yourself out of make money now mode. Yeah. Because if you're in make money now mode, it's typically because you need to make some money now because you've got a bunch of expenses and shit. And so you're like, money now. And like, you can't really build anything that great in that mode. So you really need to work hard to get out of that and develop some space, like where you can think, I'm all right now. Everything's covered and looked after. Like, now what can we do? Yeah. You broaden your horizon the more you like get yourself out of make money now mode. That's how also you think long term, by the way. You can't think beyond your like beyond your like reserves in a way. It's like trying to imagine driving like to somewhere far away on like the reserve tank. You're just not gonna do it. So you should work hard to like build up those cash reserves and then just leave them, because they I like the psychological benefit of them. Some people might say, oh, that's a waste of money. Could have put it in real estate, could have done all of that. But those people are generally poor. Or they'll say you should talk to like a financial advisor. That's another one. But these people don't have the money, so they don't know. If it was like someone that had it, I'd listen. Yeah. But the psychological advantage of it is immense. Yeah. And I know it happened to like Andrew Argue and stuff too. Once you have more than $1 million in cash, like after tax, just cleared funds, you think differently. Your balls may grow a bit bigger. But I'm not even joking, like you do like think totally different. Because you can do new moves and have longer horizons. So you want to work real hard to get yourself out of that. Like out of the make money now mode. Yeah. And you can't really build some long-term project or like spend a lot of time looking for great talent or care about a great culture when you're in make money now mode. Yeah. Those things require like space and time and effort and attention and energy and care, and you don't have that when you're frantic.
How do you maximize cash flow? Is there any strategies you have?
Well, you try to maximize money in and minimize the money out. No shit, that's why I watch it every day. So like, you look at everything. Like, the best place to cut it is in your personal life most of the time. Because your personal life is very, very like inefficient, because if you spend money, then that's tax, like, that's income money. So like, let's say you buy some fancy car and the car costs like 100K. I learned this the hard way. Then that 100K, to get it out of the company, it needs to go through the tax barrier. So that's gonna really be like 150K really, right? So you're not really burning that, you're burning that. And then you're buying something that basically is immediately going to be worth like 80. And then it's going to depreciate down. And then it's going to require insurance, which is like, and repairs and shit, which is going to add to its loss. But also this 150K could have been fed back into the machine. And that could have really turned into like 400K. But it didn't. It's now turned into like 80K that's going down. So like you're already looking at like 320 grand loss on month two, really. But the biggest way you get done with this is then to enjoy this piece of shit, you've got to use it. And that takes your time. So you're getting fucked on like eight dimensions. Honestly, like it really makes, when I started to look at it that way, I was like, I hate this thing. Get it out of my life immediately. So like, whereas if you leave it in, it doesn't pass the tax barrier. Like you still get the corporate tax, right? But that's like a lot less. And then you can keep feeding it back around and growing it. So it gets less tax and it grows instead of shrinks. And then it doesn't take up all your time and need insurance and maintenance, and it doesn't have depreciation. So like, Yeah, but do you see what I mean about, like, yeah, that's how you get really done on the personal life. Like, that's the one that gets you. So the smaller you shrink that, that's a great way to, like, plus it also does, you don't have any stress. Yeah, those ones are like, but those ones are like not, they're like more optional. Why the lifestyle ones are terrible is because like you get used to them and then like you've got to keep feeding that beast. So like, and plus they have a tendency to creep. You know what I mean? So like you're trying to fight that back too. Yeah.
Simon, that example, that's nearly a 3-to-1 turnaround, 150 to 400. That's really what I'd like to ask about. So right now we're not getting a 3-to-1. So what could we what could we do best? I know we need better ads, for example. So how do we create better ads to get that kind of a turnaround? Or how do we optimize our business to get that kind of return on our investment, which we're not getting today?
Well, in a way you kind of are, but it just, you're not seeing it instantly, because think about how much money you're making now compared to how much you were making like a year ago. What was that? What's the difference? Yeah, so it's happening. It's just not as immediately visible than you think. Because I remember, like, how long ago were you like making, you were just getting started? Yeah, so you went from like 0 to 7 figures? Like, yeah, so you're like making some growth. But it's just not as like immediately put it like visible, you know what I mean? And you're looking at the ads front, but the ads might look like they're not that profitable, and they probably aren't, but like you're still growing somehow. I think you've got to really figure out how to, the best way to get ads to work better is to be very different. Yeah. Like, no one should be able to scroll through their feed and be like, you look like everyone else.
And then just adding other channels, like consistent emails, the blogs.
Those will do wonders to profit. They won't move the needle much on revenue, but they'll move profit more than anything else you've ever seen. Yeah, so blog videos and emails won't move your revenue, but it will move up your profit by a shitload. Because think about it, it's like, it's pure profit, that money. Whereas the ads money is like, got huge cost attached to it.
So what kind of techniques can we use to create, for example, an effective blog post or send an effective email?
Well, just look at my ones and you can kind of see like what I'm trying to do. Like, I think about the user and I'm like, what does this person need help with? And then I just make some video that helps them. And then I send it to them. And then I just keep thinking, how could I help this person? How do I help this person? How do I help them? Yeah. And then every now and then I just add a little offer in there, like call to action. So how do you get more cash in? I can tell you for sure, like I've known in my business, it's the YouTube videos and the emails. Won't move your revenue up, but it'll move your profit more than anything else.
So not only have you done a call to action at the bottom, which is like a value.
You do get them? Yeah, we haven't made that change yet. You can just like register for the... No, you can go to like the... How can you get on the list easily? You could go to... Just go to the website and then go to UpLevel, like the product, and go free demo and opt in there. Yeah. That'll get you straight on, yeah. And then you'll see them, yeah.
And what's like the transition from like me just logging into the UpLevel and like you're trying to get me to watch the video, then you're trying to get me to book a call, then you're trying to get me to be sold on the call, to like the value emails, you know what I mean? Like the automated ones there to like just the campaigns that you're broadcasting. Does that make sense?
yeah, I think our like follow-up campaigns, so someone like Opsin for like some funnel, we might try and like get them to convert in like 14 to 21 days, and after that they just join the broadcast list. Gotcha. Yeah.
And are you broadcasting them as well?
No.
Just
yeah. So someone goes through there and we like get the people that are ready now, and also funds the whole ad campaign. And then the other ones just join the list, and then that stirs the pot there, and then that feeds back customers, yeah.
And so I'll go through it, so I'll see you over the next 21 days. But is it mostly like, hey, just hop back on, or are you doing like a value add in those, the automated ones, or like testimonials?
Oh, all the automated ones are like action-based, like watch the video because you didn't watch it, or book a call because you watched the video and you didn't, yeah. Accelerator ones, yes. Up-level ones, I mean, we don't have anything to sell them, like, because Quantum, we honestly don't even try. Like, we've never run an ad, we've, like, never sent an email, and, like, I don't even talk about it, and we still have to turn people down. So, like, I don't need to do anything for that.
But for up-level, do they get those broadcasts? I do get it because I'm sign up to all of your funnels, but the broadcast students, they don't get that, right?
They get the blog videos. Yeah, because I still give them the value ones, but I don't have anything directly to sell to them. Yeah. Yep.
From the free trial customers. Like the free trial customers, how much percent of them are converting into paid customers, and how many of them are getting into the up level?
I mean, the free trial converts like 25% or something, but that number, it's like, you can't compare that to like a VSL's 5% or like a webinar's 2%, because it's very different. I mean, we can talk more about that thing tomorrow, but I was trying to, like, I've made a note here, like free trial and JIT and VSL, like we can get into the weeds tomorrow and talk about the different funnels, but I'm trying to tell you how simple I actually, do you see how I'm not in the weeds here? I'm not looking at cost per click or any of that shit. I never care about cost per click unless I have to troubleshoot something. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty simple. You just want to figure out what everyone's doing, what everyone looks like, what everyone thinks, and then don't do it. Unless it's right, like you really think that's a good idea. But the cool thing is, most of the time, it doesn't make sense. Like having 9 Lamborghinis and like renting jets and having 7 mansions, that looks really dumb. Like, because of this thing I explained, right? So I quite enjoy having my shitty whiteboard and my iPhone and making videos talking for like 45 minutes about some concepts.
Do you have an iPhone again?
Pardon?
Do you have an iPhone again?
Yes.
Like the last mastermind you just told, you bought an Android.
Yeah, so I tried out Android, but then I moved back to iPhone mostly because of the video camera.
Okay.
Yeah. The video camera on the iPhone, especially the latest one, it's really good. And I don't use any crap. Like I've got to reduce the friction to making content. So I just use my iPhone to make my videos, and I don't edit at all. I just upload it straight. Bloop, done. So like I can look different by not doing all of that stuff that was dumb in the first place. So I achieve differentiation in like not waste a shitload of money at the same time, which I think is a pretty good strategy, because those other people are like looking the same and pissing out money. So like, it's great. I just hope they get another one. Like another car. All right, let's have some dinner. tomorrow we'll talk about the funnels and the marketing and we'll go into the weeds of all of that stuff.